Professor, good morning and thanks for taking your call.
Good morning, Gavin.
We heard from members of NPHET and from the government on Friday that if we were to do nothing, we'd be in a situation where we could potentially have 1,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day by the middle of next month. Is that correct?
That is possible, absolutely. And I think the starting point is that the level of virus that we have in the community right now is too high, and particularly in Dublin. And those issues that you were addressing in your review of the newspapers there, the resolution of those issues, in other words, the way not to put strain on our testing system and the way to allow sectors of our economy which are currently closed to reopen is for each and every one of us to limit our contacts, drive down the level of virus in the community, and then we can go back to the safe operation of our lives and of those businesses.
I suppose the one thing that we might clarify from the outset is the just to maybe go back over some of the logic that underpinned how Ireland approached the first wave of this. There was a general perception that although, of course, the most common incubation period is 5 to 7 days, that really sometimes it can take up to a fortnight to present. So actions that you take today, you might not see the full benefit from them for another fortnight. So is that potentially then to say that although we will hope not to have 1,000 cases by the middle of next month, that by the start of next month, we could still see the 250 or so per day now becoming closer to 500 maybe?
OK, well, let me say two things in response. So first of all, in terms of the number of cases, yes, we're at 260 on average per day right now. It all depends on what the reproduction number is. We think it's between 1.3 and 1.7. If reproduction number is 1.3, we would see 400 cases a day around the 14th of October. If it's as high as 1.8, for instance, we'd be closer to 1,500. And that's in the nature of exponential growth. Very small changes in our behaviours in reproducing the virus lead to huge differences in where we'd be in a few weeks' time. If we get the reproduction number below 1, down to, let's say, 0.9, then by the 14th of October, we'll see around 150 cases a day. So it tails off very slowly, even if we're successful. So it is. You're right, it's going to take time to see change, not as long as 2 weeks. You're right, you can see cases where the disease incubates for 14 days, but that's uncommon. The average is more like 7.
So
next week is set.
So perhaps
the week
then,
after.
To set the tone then for that week, then what sort of numbers might we be looking at or might we expect to see in the next week? And I don't mean to try and set any alarm or to try and preempt things, but rather just so we know that the battle isn't necessarily being lost by figures rising next week because the die has been cast. What are we going to see?
It's true. It's entirely possible that numbers could continue to go up at about 5% per day, so that you could be touching or over 300 cases by the end of the week. What we need to be looking for as an index of success is that case numbers stabilize over the coming weeks. And if we get them stabilized, then we can perhaps relax restrictions a little bit. But each of us continue to be very, very careful and then drive numbers down. I think the public should be watching the numbers, not every day, but where the average is going, and seek encouragement if we can get in the next few weeks these numbers stabilized and trending back downwards. And then we'll know we have the disease back under control.
Yeah, obviously the average for the last 7 days was 263, and the 7 days previous to that was 171. So it's obviously going quite a bit, and we'll hope that it steadies before too long. Obviously, one of the more contentious parts of the policies announced on Friday, at least for Dublin, is that there will be no indoor dining, at least for 3 weeks, that restaurants can only open if they're able to serve people outdoors. You posted a Twitter thread basically trying to explain that although the official figures only said there had been 3 clusters in restaurants, that maybe that wasn't really the fair story. Do you want to summarise perhaps the logic for that again?
Well, the simple issue is that we're always going to have far many more outbreaks and cases in households than we will have in the other settings. So how does the disease get into households? It gets into households by different households mixing with each other, or individuals from different households. That could be in your house, which is why the restriction is only have people over from one other household. But equally, we know from our own cases, from international evidence, that it also happens in bars, restaurants, gyms, anywhere that we get together. Unfortunately, this is a virus that likes us to socialize because it can spread. And unfortunately, our response has to be not to socialize. So just take one case. If three or four of us went from three or four different households, went to a restaurant, spread the disease amongst that party and perhaps to another party, we would have four, five, six separate household outbreaks with 10, 15, 20 cases associated with it, but only one and a small number of cases associated with the restaurant event itself. So we're going to see the disease amplified in households and lots of cases in households. But that doesn't mean the households are the problem. It means the mixing between households in other settings is the problem. So sadly, we have to have these restrictions.
So would it be fair then to summarise that with, you know, if community transmission is becoming increasingly prevalent and that's the problem, yes, that the concern is that, well, community transmission happens whenever people are congregating and indoor settings like restaurants are the prime candidates for that to happen?
Precisely that. One in four cases across the country, one in three cases at least in Dublin are community transmission. And it's happening in these settings where people gather. And unfortunately, for the next few weeks at least, we're going to have to have nobody gather in those settings. And for some weeks thereafter, each and every one of us is going to have to acknowledge that even if I can go out to a restaurant or a bar, I should limit the amount that I do that and I should limit the number of people I see there, so that I don't pick up the virus or I don't spread it to others. Mm.
One thing that you said in that Twitter thread, and I think you got a lot of people's ears up, was that you said that to a certain amount, this was, you know, best estimates, or it was a rational belief that obviously community transmission happens wherever people meet. And that's like the areas like restaurants or pubs. You said we'd like to go back and find out exactly where people are getting the virus, but we don't have the time or resources to pursue this academic exercise. And you went on later to say that, of course, your colleagues in public health would like to have the resources, yeah, to do that, but they don't. So you have to sort of, you know, make your best guess. People would look at that and think that really you're acting as something of a hunch.
No, not at all. So two things. I may have misrepresented some of my colleagues in public health, and I apologise for that. They quite frequently do go back and trace because they need to. And in some cases, when they're managing complex outbreaks, they will go back and find out, where did I get it? And yes, I got it when I visited that restaurant, and now it's possible that other people who visited the restaurant have it. So sometimes they do. So we do have our own evidence from here where we can see these patterns of spread in bars, restaurants, fitness clubs, sports events and so on. So we know it happens. It's not a hunch. What I was saying there was that we don't have the resources to do the academic research that would prove it. We have done the detective work in this country that shows the disease spreads in this way. And also we do have very considerable international evidence. So it's not a hunch. There's a strong evidence base that the virus spreads in the community in these varied settings where people, for good reason, get together to try and enjoy themselves, to play sport, to get fit. And it's one of the properties of the virus and the way it spreads that we need to, right now, because you put you highlighted the figures, how fast the disease is growing, and success for us right now is not to suppress it, it's to stabilize it and then suppress it. So when you're in that situation, knowing what we know, it's simply too risky to have people congregate in those settings.
There is perhaps, though, something of an elephant in the room when we talk about how community transmission happens wherever people were gathering. And even if you go back and look at the figures from, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I've just pulled up the figures in front of me, for example, and on Friday the 28th of August, the 7-day average was 120. And now the 7-day average, about 3.5 weeks later, is 263. And the one thing which did predominantly change in the meantime is that we've started sending 950,000 young people back into enclosed indoor settings, albeit, you know, with their pod structures or whatever. But we've sent them back into school rooms, which would seem like perhaps a far more obvious source of community infection than restaurants might be. Is there a danger, yeah, or is there really an unstated acceptance that actually schools are fueling this, but that it's a necessary evil?
No. Schools are a necessary priority, and there is no evidence that the reopening of schools was associated with any significant level of transmission of the disease within schools, and certainly no acceleration of the number of cases overall nationally. The truth is, when you look back now, it can be difficult to discern trends in very low numbers. So back in June, July, we were looking at 20 cases a day. Looking back now, it's clear that from late June into early July, and we did raise this issue later in July at press briefings, cases began to increase, and they have been increasing at somewhere between 4 and 6% per day since June. And when you've got a 4% increase on 20 cases, it's almost undetectable. Mm. When you've got a 4% increase on 200 cases, you can see it very clearly.
But it has definitely snowballed in the last 3 weeks or so. And the one parallel you could draw is that's at the time when schools have returned.
Well, when you say it snowballed in the last couple of weeks, that's in the nature of exponential growth. So what has been happening is that we've had 4 to 5% increase every day, give or take some noise, since the end of June. And that's not a linear increase, that's an exponential increase. So what you're seeing now is the roots of that increase, which are based in all of our behaviours throughout July and August and into September, beginning to accumulate in an exponential way. So there's nothing that's happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks different from the preceding 2 or 3 weeks that's contributing to this acceleration. It's simply in the nature of exponential growth that if you're piling on, let's say 5% per day, it starts small. It's like compound interest. And then suddenly you're into very large numbers. Mm. And if you even do that experiment in your head, start at 10 cases, add 5%, that's not even one 10, more case. Yeah, exactly. But if you did it day on day going back to June, you'll get to where we are without introducing any additional growth due to the opening of schools.
So without meaning then to sort of pit them against each other, and that's not how I'm trying to frame this, but that you don't have any evidence to suggest that the return of schools has contributed to this, but you do have some evidence to suggest that other casual environments like indoor dining has had something of a factor.
Absolutely. And we know that the virus spreads through contact. So we have to prioritize our contacts. So we are pitting them against each other in the sense that we've said education and healthcare are our priorities. So we need to keep them open and we need to have contact in those settings. And therefore, if we have to reduce contact in other settings, we'll have to reduce contact in those other settings.
Okay, I know you're obviously predominantly in the whole modelling field, so the whole medicinal side of things isn't necessarily the aspect that you bring to NPHET, but as a member of NPHET, are you concerned about the apparent slowdown in some of the contact tracing where people who have, you know, tested positive, they might be waiting for a contact tracing call for their nearest and dearest for several days, and that people could still be going out and about potentially carrying the virus and not having been intercepted by the system in the meantime?
So, absolutely, there are targets for contact tracing, and if there's any slippage from those targets, that is a cause for concern. I at the same time, I have to say, if you look at the testing system that the HSE established at the peak of the pandemic, that's been enhanced and strengthened ever since. By international standards, it is a very strong system. And when we had those, a very significant increase in load associated with the Clare Leash and Offaly outbreaks, it showed the strain for 12, 24 hours, but didn't fall over. And systems in other jurisdictions have done very badly under similar levels of strain. As we enter into the winter, and I know Paul Reid has reported us talking about this separately, as we enter into the winter, the HSE face a very significant task, and they know about that task and they're gearing up for it to ensure that they have the capacity to address. There will be an increase in referrals as other respiratory illnesses increase, and the HSE know they'll need to be in a position to address that.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Professor Philip Nolan, President of Maynooth University and Chair of the Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group at NPHET. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Gavin.